Until 11, local, national and international affairs, plus some goss and scandal. You're listening to Mitchell's Front Page on 94.7 The Pulse.
And coming up a little bit later on this hour, we will be looking at Monday's sport and just talking about the opening of the stadium on Friday night. And I wonder if our panel might have a few comments on the promotion that incited people to boo. Was that the right thing to do? But now it's a great pleasure to welcome to the program Richard Miles, who is, of course, the Shadow Defence Minister and also federal member for Corio. Richard, good morning.
Good morning, Mitchell. I hadn't heard that. I wasn't there on Friday night, unfortunately, because I was flying back from overseas, but that doesn't sound like the normal football tradition.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit concerning for me, just given what had happened with Adam Goods and the fact that we had to try and present this united image with him, but it's like, are there different rules for different players? I'm not sure, or different teams?
Well, I think there can be a difference in how that's obviously expressed. I've been to a couple of American sporting events where there's definitely a kind of home stadium advantage, and there's no doubt that part of that is obviously pantomime and, you know, is part of the theatre of going, so maybe that's what's going on here, but it's not really been the culture of AFL.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. Now, on to the budget, which I think everyone is talking about. Commentators have described the budget as being Labor-light because it raises taxes and increases spending, and I note, according to an article in The Conversation, that spending is pretty much higher on some measures than under Kevin Rudd under the peak of the global financial crisis. So do you agree with that characterisation, that it's a Labor-light budget?
Not exactly, no. I don't think it's a budget which contains Labor priorities in it. I mean, what Labor is about is helping those who need help the most, protecting our most vulnerable, investing in education. I mean, these are the strong Labor brands or issues that have defined the Labor brand over a long period of time, and you don't find that in this budget. I mean, this is a budget which cuts $22 billion from education over the course of the next decade, so that has a huge impact. This is a budget which is cutting spending to universities, which is making students have to pay more. It still is the case that this is a budget which makes it harder for those who are receiving support and who are the most vulnerable within our community. So this is not a budget that Labor would ever hand down, and its values certainly don't speak to, or the values it represents don't speak to Labor values. What I would say, though, is it's hard to discern from this budget any conservative values either. I mean, typically conservatives come to the political table with a proposition of smaller government, less taxes, less spending. That's not what this budget is. I mean, as you pointed out, this is actually a high tax, high spend budget. It's got its priorities wrong in terms of where it's spending. But this doesn't represent a traditionally conservative budget either, which then really begs the question, which has been the question all along in relation to Malcolm Turnbull: who is he, and what is he about, and what does he stand for? Because you cannot draw a line through his behaviour other than political steps to try and counter Labor, to try and deal with his own, the right wing of his own party room. But in terms of what he believes in, what he's about, what this government is trying to do in office, we are deeply confused, as is the Australian people, and I think this budget's just another step in that process.
On Labor values and taxation, I saw some comments from Paul Keating, which said that the highest tax rate shouldn't be more than 39 cents in the dollar, because he says it's not fair to ask people to work one day for themselves and one day for the government, because obviously with this Medicare levy increase, the highest rate of tax in Australia is getting up towards 50 cents in the dollar now.
I guess the point we would make in relation to how the budget was constructed is that the removal of the deficit levy for those who were paying the highest, and that's who was paying the deficit levy, whilst at the same time putting in place an increase in the Medicare levy, had the outcome that if you were earning less than average wages in this budget, you got a tax increase. If you were a millionaire, you actually got a tax cut. I mean, that's what this budget did. Again, there's nothing Labor in terms of the way that is constructed, and whatever else that is, what it most definitely is not, is fair. I mean, this is a deeply unfair proposition. So, you know, we have been about trying to make sure, well, I mean, we've always believed in a progressive taxation system where those who earn more pay more and those who can't afford to pay as much are not required to. That to us speaks to a fair society, and this budget actually was precisely the opposite.
Now, on education funding, I think it was interesting that the Australian Education Union was down here in Geelong just a few weeks ago talking about, you know, I give a Gonski in that line. And now, of course, the federal government has used David Gonski. So can they now say that they also give a Gonski because it's got the David Gonski seal of approval?
Well, look, I mean, people can play with David Gonski's name all they want. I mean, at the end of the day, it boils down to what actual policy you're putting on the ground, and I come back to the point I made earlier. What we had proposed in terms of fully funding a needs-based funding education system would be $22 billion more over the next decade than what is proposed in this budget. That is the raw bottom line in terms of the difference of priority that the government are placing upon education compared to Labor. So, I mean, whatever label you want to put on that, what I say is we are the party for education. They are evidently not. We understand that in order to compete in this part of the world, in East Asia, during the course of this century, we're going to have to invest much more in our education at all levels, from preschool through to university. And that's what our policies have consistently been about from the, we've always been a supporter of education, but certainly through the Rudd-Gillard years and under Bill Shorten, our policies are very much directed to properly funding education. This budget is not doing that.
Where will that $22 billion come from? And also, is it tied to results? The reason I ask is that over the last 10 years, from what I understand, funding per head of the student population has gone up by 40%, but yet on some measures, by academic standards, we're still behind Kazakhstan. So we seem to be sort of going backwards as funding increases.
I'm not sure it's a... I mean, I think that the observation that we need to be improving our standing globally in terms of our educational outcomes is absolutely right. I mean, we cannot afford to be falling down that ladder, and all of our efforts have to be directed towards reversing that and actually seeing Australia climb the international rankings when it comes to education and educational results. So there's no question about that. I wouldn't necessarily agree that I think that to set up a sort of a suggestion which is that the more you spend on education, the worse the results. I mean, I don't accept that at all. And I think ultimately when you look at how much countries around the world spend on education, the consistent message is that the more you fund it, the better results you get from it.
But does it show that we haven't targeted the funding correctly?
Well, I think, you know, how you spend the money matters too. There's no question of that. And we need to be making sure that we get that right. But just in answer to your first question, where do we fund, how would we pay for this? Right now, the government has on the table a tax cut for big businesses, which will cost the budget $50 billion over the course of the next 10 years. $50 billion. We're talking about a $22 billion increase in education spending as compared to what the government's proposing. That's one measure right there. I mean, if they got rid of the giveaway to big companies, there would be money in the budget. The negative gearing proposition that we put forward, significant savings associated with that over the course of 10 years, again, the government could adopt that. It would do something for housing affordability as well. I don't think there's a serious economist around who doesn't think that we need to have action in relation to negative gearing. This is a government which has chosen politics, though, on this issue over policy, which they do on almost everything else. So there are ways in which you can fund spending, and that needs to occur, and we do need to be looking at this in a prudent way, and we are. I mean, as an opposition, we've come up with more propositions for budget repair than I think probably any opposition in history, but the point of doing that is so that you can spend on what are the priorities of the nation, and education is right up there as an absolute fundamental key to the future of our country.
You describe negative gearing reform as a saving, but doesn't that just mean that people out there that are investors are just spending more money in taxation towards the government? So, yes, it might somehow be a saving for the government, but it basically means government spending is going up and the burden of taxation on people is going up.
Well, it's an improvement to the bottom line, but I think you can describe it as a saving in as much as what this is a tax break which is provided to people who are investing in that way, which is an expense on the budget. And you know, we get into a fine kind of argument about how, you know, whether things are accounted for in terms of revenue or expenditure, but if you want to go down that path, there are actually people who are specialists in this area would talk about this as in effect an expenditure, given that what you are doing is providing a tax break towards an end, which originally was about trying to stimulate the construction of housing, but nowadays sees 9 in 10 investors investing in existing housing stock, so it's actually not achieving what it sought to or what it was intended to achieve when it was first introduced. And of course, as you know, for those seeking to invest in new housing stock, which was the original aim, negative gearing we would still allow, so that you know, you're not doing anything to reduce the supply. But negative gearing associated with existing housing stock, you know, is not a productive spend of the budget, and that's why we need to reform it.
On the freezing of Medicare, your Facebook post says, you know, Malcolm Turnbull is only unfreezing about 7% of Medicare, and you said that this is evidence of his continual undermining of the Medicare system. Does that mean that when Labor froze these payments originally, that they were also undermining Medicare?
Look, when we when that occurred, it was for a short period of time, and it was stated as such at the time that that budget measure was taken under the Gillard government, and it was a, I mean, that's why it was termed as a freezing for a period of time. No one imagined then that you would extend that into freezing it into the 2020s, which is where things would have been, but for the campaign that we've been running and now seeing the very modest changes that Malcolm Turnbull is putting in place. But what he's doing are modest. I mean, this is not an unfreezing of Medicare. Years down the track from when it was meant to have been unfrozen, this is, as the Facebook post suggests, unfreezing a small amount of it, and there remains a huge difference between the government and Labor when it comes to how Medicare should be funded and what those Medicare rates should be.
Now, moving away from the budget, I saw that Bill Shorten came and paid a visit to Geelong on Thursday. What were some of the key messages that you were trying to communicate there? I know that the advertisers run with this idea that you're trying to be competitive in Corangamite, and why wouldn't you? Because it's obviously one of the key seats that you have to win at the next election.
Yeah, well, and that's absolutely right. I mean, Corangamite is obviously a marginal seat, and it will be a focus of our attention in this election, as it has been, of course, in elections past. I think the big issue in Geelong, education is an important issue in Geelong as well. I've often talked about Deakin University being as important an institution to Geelong as any, in terms of its research funding, in terms of the people who work for it, in terms of what it does. It's a huge stimulator and driver of our local economy. It has been cut dramatically by this government. When Labor was in power, it grew by a full 50%. So the education funding debate, which we've been talking about, resonates heavily specifically in Geelong. But the main issue is jobs, and we've obviously experienced some significant economic shocks in our town with the decisions that have been made by Alcoa and Ford. The federal government has basically abandoned Geelong in terms of trying to assist us through that period. It has so in relation to infrastructure spending, in that we've seen basically nothing. And so I think that the message that we want to give is that Geelong is very much a focus of our thinking. It certainly was when we were in government. I mean, when we were in government, we saw record amounts of federal expenditure in Geelong. That says everything about where Geelong sits in terms of our priorities. Under the Turnbull and Abbott governments, we've seen basically nothing. But at a time when actually we really needed help. We needed help through a significant economic shock and where people have really been struggling with jobs. This conservative government have been hopeless. I mean, at the end of the day, the Liberals don't care about Geelong, and that's patently clear.
I think they might disagree, but that's fair enough.
But they will, of course, contest that proposition, but you can listen to whatever I say, whatever Sarah Henderson says, for example, but just have a look at the facts. That they speak much louder than anything any of us can say, and it is patently clear that they have spent nothing, or virtually nothing, in Geelong. And relative to what was spent during that period under Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard, it is chalk and cheese.
Now, the convention centre, what do you make about this whole debate about the business case and all that sort of thing? Because I understand the new stadium now has 1,000 seats to have a conference-type facility there, so the convention centre would presumably need to be bigger than that to cater for a different market.
I think Geelong lends itself well to a convention centre. I do think there needs to be a deeper debate about this. It's become a sort of a buzzword in terms of what is being sought by our community, and in a way I think it needs to be argued in more depth if we're going to actually cut through with policy makers. I am a supporter of a convention centre, and for this reason, because we are a contained place relative to Melbourne or Sydney, because we've got actually quite good proximity to Tullamarine as much as anything as a major airport with schedules all around the country, because we have our own local media market, Geelong is a place which people like to bring conventions to. In a former life when I was at the ACTU, I was responsible for the ACTU Congress, which is about 1,000 people over 3 or 4 nights. Back then we were looking actually at one point of holding the ACTU Congress in Geelong, which would have been the biggest conference to have been held in Geelong at that time. This is in the early 2000s. Mm. The reason we couldn't was because there was no place where you could have the dinner at the end of the conference. There was no venue where, that's actually not true, you could have done it at the arena, but that's a fair way out of town and less desirable. But other than that, there was no ability to set up in a kind of classroom style, which means with a desk in front of everyone, a venue which could seat 1,000 people. As a result, the conference wasn't held there. I think it was held in Melbourne instead, it was okay. The problem, though, with conferences that are held in Melbourne is once it gets to 5 o'clock, everyone disappears and you don't see them again until the next day. And it's actually that's the reason why holding a conference in Geelong is so good. It has a life which extends beyond the formal hours of the convention and is an experience throughout the entirety of the week that you're here, because people are more contained and it has a much better feel. So I do think if we had the right facilities, there is a huge market for Geelong to attract, and we would do better than places like Townsville or Wollongong or Newcastle. We are much closer to Tullamarine than they are to Mascot, or in the case of Townsville, obviously, they're a long way from Brisbane. That's why we need it. But that's the way in which this needs to be argued. Now, I actually think the stadium at the football ground will help, but I don't think it does everything. And I think there is still room for a convention centre in Geelong which would enable this to occur. But this has to be argued more than simply saying, other towns have got a convention centre, we need one too. We actually need to be out there making the argument about why it would work for us, what conferences we're trying to attract and what we're trying to achieve here.
Final question. In the newspaper there is an article saying that you're tight-lipped about possible tensions between Elbow and Shorter. Now, I don't expect you to comment on that, but does this sort of undermine the message that you're trying to put out there, which is Labor has learned its lesson of the disunity and also the government sort of lacking a bit of unity at the moment? We're trying to be the unified opposition. Does this media coverage, whether it's about the video with Bill Shorten talking about 457 visas or the response to the budget, does it undermine that central message?
Well, I mean, look, there's nothing in this. I mean, I was astounded as I opened the paper today. I you know, managed to get my photo in the paper this morning for saying absolutely nothing, which surprised me.
That's good when you're a politician, isn't it? To get media coverage for not doing anything.
Well, I don't want to make that a habit, but to be fair, that is what the story represents this morning. We have been incredibly unified since losing office back in 2013, and you know that followed on a period of time where obviously we were not unified, and it was a very difficult time, and I think all of us have learned from that. And our actions demonstrate it. From time to time, stories are going to get written, and I don't think there's a way around that in politics. But I'm also really confident that when it comes to stories about disunity, when it actually comes to the facts of disunity or unity, this is a story which is all on the government side. They are the ones where, you know, everyone is wondering who's going to take them to the next election. I actually don't think this is an issue on the Labor side at all.
Well, Richard, thank you very much for your time once again. Always good to catch up, and we'll hopefully speak to you next month.
Look forward to it, Mitchell.
Thank you, Richard Miles there, the Federal Member for Corio and also Shadow Defence Minister.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye. Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.